Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the New Book Network for the Journal of Women's History. My name is Dina Hassan. I'm a lecturer at the University of Oklahoma. I did my PhD in linguistics, and I was a previous Fulbright scholar at Boston University. I'm so happy today to welcome Dr. Nicola Pratt. She's an associate professor in the Politics and International Studies Department at the University of Warwick, UK, and Vice President of the British Society for the Middle Eastern Studies. She teaches and researches on the international politics of the Middle East with a particular interest in feminist and decolonial approaches and a focus on politics from below. She has written and co-edited a number of books on women and gender in the Middle East. Her most recent monograph, entitled Embodying Geopolitics, Generations of Women's Activism in Egypt, Jordan, and Lebanon, was published by University of California Press in fall 2020. She has also written extensively on Egyptian politics from below and is currently co-authoring a book on popular culture and the contested meanings of the 2011 Egyptian Revolution, which is also the subject of multimedia digital archive that she co-authored. So welcome, Nicola. It's such a pleasure and honor to be with you today. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Dina. It's such a pleasure for me to be here as well. And thank you for all your, you know, for all your work in spending time to read my book. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Well, let me start by congratulating you on such a wonderful book. I can't express how happy and engaged I was reading this book because it felt so much at home for me. Being an Egyptian woman myself and having witnessed a lot of what you talk about in your book, whether firsthand, like in the Egyptian Revolution in 2011, moving forward, or things that also I have learned about the history of my country and my region. And you tackle all of that in a very skillful way and such an engaging book. I'm so happy, really, that I have read this book, and I'm so happy to have this conversation with you. So thanks again.
Thank you. That's too kind.
So I would like to start with the very first thing that I saw when I had this book in my hand, which is the image of the book cover. So I see a woman that is half veiled. She's looking upwards. Her expressions are really mixed between frustration and hope at the same time. To me, the image was a little intriguing, and it just got me curious about whether that is something that you chose yourself, or was it the publisher, and what does it signify to you taking into consideration the interviews that you have been doing throughout the whole Arab region?
Thanks, Dina, for this question. So I spent a lot of time thinking about the image for the cover, and not just the cover of this book, actually, because before publishing the book, I gave a number of talks at different venues, you know, as I was sort of going through the research process and beginning to formulate my thoughts. And every time I gave a talk at a venue, you know, they also ask you for an image that can be used for the poster to publicize the talk. So actually this image originated as a part of a poster for one of the talks I gave early on before my book was published. And the image is actually a painting by a Jordanian Palestinian artist called Marwa Najjar. And I came across her work whilst I was in Jordan. And I think her images are just so beautiful. She has many beautiful images. And this one caught my attention because I thought it's so difficult to choose an image for a subject such as women's activism in the Middle East without falling into traps of cliches and sort of orientalist cliches, but also sort of the dangers of misrepresenting what women's the diversity of women's activism in the region. So, you know, it's problematic, for example, just to have an image with women marching in a protest, because a lot of women don't, that's not the style of activism that they do. And it's problematic if you have only women with headscarves, but then again, you can't have an image just of women with no headscarves. So there's this sort of minefield with regards to visual representation of women in the Middle East. So I wanted to avoid all of that. So this painting spoke to me because on the one hand, it sort of is signifying a woman belonging to, we can identify her as a woman belonging perhaps to the Middle East region, not just because of the scarf on the head, which also could be a hoodie. You know, there's an ambiguity about it. Like, you could look at it as like it's a hoodie, or you could look at it as though it's a scarf. But also the colours, very evocative of sort of Amman, Jordan, you know, with the sandstone colour of the houses there. So there was that sort of linking to place as well, which obviously is an important theme in the book. And I read the image as a woman staring into the future. So looking to the future, not knowing maybe exactly what's going to happen, but at least that's sort of like an optimistic type of, has that sort of optimistic type of sentiment to it. So again, sort of avoiding ideas of misery or, you know, so for me, the image avoided a lot of the problems that could come up with images of, you know, visual representations of women in the Middle East. And at the same time, I just love the artwork of this artist, Marwa Najjar.
Thank you, Nicola. I really loved your talk about the image and how it falls out of the trap of categorizing women under one category or the other. So it's really telling about the book, and it's intriguing in a way that lets you want to read the book and see what is this expression about on her face. So thanks for that. I would like to start actually with the very first quotation in your book, which is also intriguing. It's a quotation by Hala Shukrullah, or those are her exact words. So she says, quote, "Somehow when you get involved, there's a sense of obligation that grows with you. And it always makes you feel like I can't go, I can't leave. And it's weird that you have that sense, because a lot of people who were also involved didn't have. They left and they immigrated. So I have always been thinking, why so some of us have that sense. And it's a false sense because life does go on without you. So why one has that sense that it's important to be in the middle of these things, I have no idea. I'm trying to make sense, but I have no idea why, unquote. So this quotation of hers is really remarkable, and it's rightly placed on the very first page of the book. I myself felt it's very relevant, and I cannot deny that I have had similar thoughts at different stages of my life. And I wonder, what were your thoughts on this particular quotation, and what was your reasoning for giving it that prominent position in the book? Were there certain elements of Hella's story that you related to more than others? Did her words sound true for other women who probably could not articulate it the way she did? Is it your own assessment of women's situation that's summarized in this quote? So could you just tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, thanks for asking me. So that actually that quote spoke quite deeply to me. I was quite touched by that quote. So it spoke to me on an individual level, which is about this feeling of obligation and how it's so difficult to escape. And I guess one of the things that intrigues me is that on the one hand, you know, being an activist is supposed to be a sign of freedom and autonomy, but actually it doesn't feel like that. It feels like an obligation. And even when you're very impassioned for the cause that you're fighting for, it takes time away from your family, from your friends. So this is something I felt about my own activism, but it was definitely a theme that in one way or another came up in a lot of the interviews, you know, that activism is a sacrifice in many ways of people's personal lives, of their family lives. So it's not so simple as to think that just because women are active, that therefore, you know, this is a sign of liberation or something, you know.
All right. You talk about your motivation for writing this book, since you're talking about your activism. And, you know, and I quote from your own words, I was motivated to write against a prevalent discourse at the time promoted by Western media, policymakers, NGOs, and think tanks, among others, that viewed women's participation in protests as new and exceptional. Such attitudes reflected an Orientalist epistemology, denying the possibility of women's agency within Arab Muslim culture, unquote, and viewing it instead as an expression of Western values and of freedom and autonomy. So I was just curious as to what made you view those ideas as unreasonable and drive you to take a journey to explore the truth behind such Orientalist views, and how did the idea come to you in the first place, if you would like us to know more about it?
I've been very influenced by this post-Orientalist turn in scholarship on the Middle East. So it has been quite central to all of my scholarship to try to not just challenge, but in some way dismantle Orientalist assumptions about the Middle East that continue to have such they continue to live on in so many forms, you know, not just in scholarship, but obviously in popular culture, in political discourse. And, you know, I very much follow on in from Edward Said in seeing these types of stereotypes about the Middle East, about people from the Middle East, as not just dehumanizing, but also as quite crucial to the ongoing domination of Western powers over the Middle East, which I see as a negative thing. So in general, that's a, you know, that's a sort of theme that runs through all my scholarship. And I think the what was interesting about the moment of the Arab uprisings in 2011 is, again, how we see that policymakers and the media in the West, they're unable to break out of these Orientalist stereotypes, which see the world in these very binary terms, you know, West as progressive and the Middle East as somehow backward in scare quotes, and with women being the principal markers of that cultural and fundamental difference between the West and the Middle East. Sorry. So, yes, that's really the one of the factors that led me to start engaging in this, in the topic for the book. And I'm not the first person to write about the history of women's activism. Lots of other scholars have written also on this topic, and if I begin to mention some names, I'm sure I'll offend some of those who I forget to mention. So I'm not going to start on the long list of brilliant feminist scholars of the Middle East who've documented women's activism. What I wanted to do that was slightly different maybe was to really look at the long sweep of women's activism, going from colonial, bit sort of the anti-colonial struggle to the present day, because that's something that generally isn't done. And I think that allows us to understand the evolution of women's activism over time and to historicize it. So to historicize the present, in order to understand the significance of the present, I think it's important to understand the past. So that's how I started on this journey of looking at the long history of women's activism in order to really contextualize and understand the present moment, or what was then the present moment. We've moved on quite significantly in time since I finished researching for the book. But
yeah, I was just going to say thank you for taking such a journey to find out the truth and allow those women to voice their own stories and their own hopes and their own frustrations instead of the typical way of just talking on their behalf, like you're saying, and just orientalizing women in a discourse that has lasted for so long. And we long for such books like yours that help us get a different perspective, particularly that it's based on firsthand experience and women's voices. That's really a remarkable achievement. So thank you for that. It's interesting that you based your journey on scholarship in the first place, and then that led you to a journey to listen to women's voices in the first place? Or was it the other way around? Did you ever meet Arab women and they started talking to you and that kind of sparked your interest to start on a journey? Or was it scholarship in the first place and then that's what led you to do those interviews?
So that's also a really important question. For me, I try to make my scholarship as sort of integral to my activism and my everyday life in many ways. And I was very lucky to live in Egypt for a few years in the 1990s. My relationship to Egypt in particular and into the Middle East region in general began because I studied Arabic at university. My first degree was in Arabic. And as a result of that, I visited Egypt and spent some time there. And then I loved it so much, I went afterwards after I finished my first degree. And so it's from a longer term engagement with Egypt in particular, but other after that I visited other countries and had and stayed there also for differing amount of times. But it's through that longer engagement in the region that I have developed an interest to study the region and for me, something like challenging Orientalism is not just it's not just about scholarship. It is also, again, linked to my political concerns about the Western interventions in the region. It's been part of my activism in the anti-war movement, and you know, also as a feminist, I have an interest in women's lives and also a commitment to listening to women's voices. So all of these things for me are all intertwined, like my scholarly interests, my activist interests, and just my life experiences.
That's very interesting, because I was wondering about that on a personal level, like how did you come to this realization that you want to set on this journey and here to listen to women's voices. So thanks for talking about this part of your life of living in Egypt and learning Arabic yourself. Thank you. I would like now to get us to the core argument in your book. And from what I understand, you mentioned that women's activism should be viewed as an embodied geopolitics. So could you please elaborate more on your core argument? You talk about the importance of everyday life of ordinary men and women as a significant site in exercise of and resistance to geopolitical power. So what about the interaction between the personal and the political, which I do see come up a lot in the book, and how are both aspects shaped and are shaped by the other? Also, what were your ideas before the interviews about that kind of intersection? And did they change in any way after you did the interviews, or did they just reconfirm what your previous ideas were?
Yeah, so of course, it's a long-standing feminist slogan, the personal is political. And then that slogan was taken up by a feminist scholar called Cynthia Enloe, who's writing in the field of international relations, and she talked about the personal is also international or political. So this was something that I really wanted to examine in depth in relation to the Middle East region and women's lives there. The actual a term, embodied geopolitics, is a term that I have borrowed from feminist geopolitics, and it is a term that I came to after I did the interviews. So let's say when I did the interviews, I had this sort of feminist curiosity about how the political and the personal, or the internationally political and the personal, intersect in women's lives. But after doing the interviews, that's when I came to this interest in specifically the embodied nature of women's activism. So what struck me is that when women, as women activists, what's often ignored in a lot of literature is that they are, you know, that first of all, that activism is an embodied practice. That it's not just about women sitting in offices or in seminars and talking, or talking amongst themselves, or talking to other people, whether government officials or grassroots communities or something. It's also about what does it mean when women go as women, as gendered bodies, into the public sphere and perform their activism in a variety of ways. So that can include, for example, being in a protest. That can include going into a low-income neighborhood and providing social services of various kinds. It does include women sitting in seminars and talking, but it can include a whole range of different activities that are all embodied in, you know, they're all forms of embodied performance, which have differential effects depending on the context and the specific place in which they take place, but also the wider socio-political and geopolitical context. So this is what struck me, for example, when women talk to me about, particularly when they've transgressed dominant gender norms, this is where it really becomes apparent, because there's, when women tell those stories about being part of a protest or standing up to authority in various ways, these types of particularly spectacular types of activism where there's a real potential of confrontation between women activists and authority, police, also confrontation with family members, standing up to fathers, brothers, and that's when you see in particular how it's in that transgression of dominant norms that it really became obvious to me how activism is embodied, and that's what led me to also think about how that might change over time. You know, why is it sometimes so spectacular, but other times it might be quite mundane? So what are the factors that are shaping that? And tracing, again, the importance of tracing that history of women's activism really allows you to understand the different factors that might come into play at different moments that that shape women's activism, and in particular the differences between, you know, women in anti-colonial struggle, for example, versus the way women have been co-opted into and also have actively participated in post-colonial state building, how they've participated in political movements and protests against regimes. So all these different sort of examples of different moments of struggle have had different implications then for shaping women's activism.
That's very interesting. Actually, I love that your book spans a long period of time that helps people who are not familiar with the region and its history understand the background of the political influence on the women's activists and the progression of them gaining the rights at one point throughout history and then taking some steps back. So that offers a really good overview for people who are not familiar with the region. And it helps people, educators like myself. I try to teach literature, and as I'm particularly interested in Arab women literature, and I understand you focus more on politics of the Middle East than literature, but like I'm saying, a book like yours does help a lot in classes that we teach about literature, because literature could focus more, like you are saying, maybe on the personal side of the story, because we do hear like women talking about how that, like you're saying, affects their relationships with male partners and their lives or family members. So we do see that, but then a book like yours helps students and helps teachers talk in a broader way about the political and in addition to the social element of the movement. So again, thank you for that. I'm really happy with this book.
Can I just add as well, it's so important to highlight how gender relations have changed over time, just within the 20th century into the 21st century. it's also about challenging these sort of Orientalist assumptions about the region, as though nothing ever changes, you know, that women's oppression in the Middle East is, you know, something static and constant. But actually what was important for me to show in the book is how, for example, in the sort of immediate period of the after independence, those first couple of decades, just how much progress women made, and then how much that was threatened as a result of changes at the geopolitical changes at the regional level, you know, how the defeat of Arab nationalism as a result of the Six-Day War in 1967, how that really then threatened some of those gains. And, you know, what's important is not to see things only in terms of progress, linear progress, but to understand the ups and the downs, and, you know, that there's never, you know, we can't just sort of easily there's also an issue that we can't easily categorize something as a example of progress, or an example of failure, that there's also a lot of grey areas in between, and there's incremental changes that happen, and then there's sudden changes that happen. You know, that there's a whole mix of different changes that are happening, and that actually we see as a very dynamic, vibrant and fluid situation when it comes to women's rights and gender relations in the Middle East region.
That's very true, because again, it helps us get out of the trap of binaries, and that women are either activists or oppressed human beings. And so that's one of the wonderful things about this book, is that it helps us see the gray areas, like you're saying, and the complex elements involved in the life of women. That's not either or one way or the other. So thanks about that. My next question to you is that you also note, and I quote from your words, "A key site for the construction of cultural difference, and hence the constriction of national sovereignty, was and remains the female body." So we were talking, unquote, we were talking about the personal versus the political aspect of women's lives. But of course, the female body has been subject of so much discourse, whether in the Middle East or in the West, or Western discourse about Middle Eastern women. So my question to you is, how do you see the difference between the West and the Middle East in terms of the infringement on the female body to create standards that women have to follow? And how far do you think women have gone in fighting that kind of infringement, whether in on the discourse level or whether on the personal level?
Yeah. So my observation is that the strength of the discourse of national sovereignty is pretty universal. I mean, we live in a world where the nation state still remains the preeminent unit of governance, and for most people the preeminent unit with which they identify. And I think it shows that, and I think also universally, you know, gender is very important to that construction of national sovereignty, but in different ways, you know, in different countries. I mean, there, for example, this, what I talk about in the book, about the concept of female respectability and how women's public behavior, you know, is expected to conform to a norm of female respectability, in which women are both, to borrow Afsaneh Najmabadi's phrase, women are both modest yet but modern at the same time. And I think you can see that sort of idea present across many countries and many continents, that the women, in particular women, when women go into the public sphere, their modesty is something that's like focused on. There's a lot of attention on how women dress, how you know, how many sexual partners they have, and you know, it's just a maybe different degrees to which that happens in different countries. So definitely this is, I think, something that for all women going into the public sphere, they face this norm that's regulating them. And the degree to which it's possible for women to challenge that norm is, I think, constrained by its association with constructions of national sovereignty. Because if you overtly challenge it, then you risk to be seen as somehow challenging, you're like almost like a traitor to your nation, you know, to try and step beyond these sorts of dominant gender norms. And therefore, I think for the most part, women often don't overtly challenge the relationship between certain gender norms and the construction of national sovereignty, because to do so would put them in a very precarious place. So they work within those constraints. And of course, women can make gains. They can leverage their national belonging, their national identity, and play with, you know, sort of negotiate gender norms within certain parameters and still make the sorts of claims that they want to make, demands for women's rights. In some cases, they can even justify the claims for certain women's rights based on what is good and proper within, you know, a particular national context. So I see that this relationship between certain gender norms and national and constructions of national sovereignty is actually very difficult to challenge, and it would to do so outright would involve the formulation of a sort of feminist discourse that is completely sort of challenging the whole basis in which international relations is organized, which is not to say it's impossible, but it's a very big task. And I think quite understandably, most women are focused much more on tasks that seem closer to home.
Right. Well, I love that you're saying that it's completely impossible, because as you were talking, I was just thinking that, I mean, even in the US, I see when women do some sort of activism or get engaged politically or are outrageous and outspoken for good reasons, I would say, they do face a lot of backlash, and they are categorized also in certain ways, and they're not necessarily welcomed. So I don't know if it's impossible or if it's always going to be an ongoing struggle between what women want to achieve, and there is always going to be a backlash from haters and from people who still think that women should not be involved in such acts of political activism and speaking the rights and even talking about their own bodies and the Me Too movement, for example. So do you think it's possible at all, or do you think it's always going to be that way?
I think it is possible if women, not just women, also women and their allies, they stand in solidarity. And one of the things that I think was observable from the interviews that I conducted is that at those moments in history where there's been a broad movement for social change, for challenging the political status quo, such as after the defeat of in the 1967 war, when you have the emergence of new radical social movements and political movements, and women were part of those. I think it was much easier for women to, and a similar situation, you know, in 2011 and afterwards with the uprisings, it's much easier then for women to challenge dominant gender norms, because they're able to insert their agenda for change into a wider agenda for socio-political change. So it's that, it's having that, those alliances with other movements, as well as sort of having the solidarity of other women, that allow, that gives the possibility, I think, to really challenge existing power structures and dominant norms.
Right. Solidarity, like you're saying, is definitely the key, I guess, for women to move forward, which gets me to the point you talk about in your book about the politicizing of feminism. And you note that state feminism signaled the progressive character of the regime, thereby contributing to the regime's legitimacy, particularly vis-a-vis its main political rival, the Muslim Brotherhood. We're talking about the Nasser era in Egypt. So Nasser ridiculed the Muslim Brotherhood's attitudes towards women's rights, characterizing them as reactionary and a threat to the gains of the Egyptian revolution. So I would like to hear from you about how women you interviewed expressed that idea, and whether women advocated for the importance of looking at feminist issues from a social justice perspective instead of it being just tied to political figures and movements. Also, how far do you think that trend of politicizing women's rights has allowed women to gain or lose their fight to get the desired status in the society?
Yeah, so, I mean, of course, feminism is a it is political. As a feminist, I would say it is political, although interestingly, a lot of women rights activists would try and distance themselves from politics, because the, again, the dominant sort of ideas about women and politics is that, you know, it's not a respectable arena or it's a questionable arena for women to participate in. So actually, I think either for strategic reasons or because women have also internalized that idea, a lot of women would not call their women's rights activism political. The whole point of my book is to show that despite that, it obviously does have very political implications. I think what your question points to is the very long-standing association of women's rights and state feminism in the Arab world, and in particular, although I don't think it's not just confined to the Arab world, and the difficult choices that can throw up for women activists, given that these state feminist regimes also happen to be authoritarian, and since the 1970s also putting forward, you know, structural adjustment programs and dismantling sort of social welfare infrastructure that was there as a safety net for some of the poorest and most vulnerable people in society. So that association with state feminism, think different women have different attitudes towards it. So that you can't, and you can see both advantages and disadvantages depending on what your criteria of assessment are. If your goal is to achieve as many legal rights for women as possible, then allying with regimes in their state feminist projects can actually be a really good way of achieving that goal. if your goal, if you see women's rights as part of a wider project of social justice, then collaborating with state feminism is not seen as such a good thing. So I found women on both sides of that sort of divide, women who were happy to, well, when I say happy to, they had taken the decision to collaborate with state feminism because they saw it as progress, as the having shared interest in progressing women's legal rights. And then there were women who refused to do that on the grounds that it was they would not collaborate with a regime that was dictatorial or repressive in any way. So, and then, you know, there are some women who maybe veer in between those depending on just how bad the regime is at any one point in time. I think, you know, the Nasser regime was seen for almost all women that I spoke to in Egypt as a very positive period in Egyptian history, because not only was, although Nasser was authoritarian, he did have also this political project that was not just about state feminism, but also about redistribution of wealth and support for workers and peasants. And, you know, many of the women that I interviewed came from families originally who were of very humble background, but because of the reforms that Nasser introduced, they were able to, you know, become socially mobile and become the new middle class sort of thing. So Nasser is seen as quite a positive period, despite him being authoritarian. And of course, in the more recent time, a lot of women were happy to support the Sisi regime because they saw that Sisi had saved Egypt from the Muslim Brotherhood, and therefore that was a positive thing, not just for women's rights, but for the future of Egypt in general. So different women have very different positions when it comes to their relationship to the state. There's not one position.
Yes, and I guess that gets us back to the idea of getting away from binaries, and there isn't one way or the other of doing things. It could be that the achievements that women have managed to fulfill so far is actually a combination of all of those efforts together, depending on the political figure, depending on the political circumstances and the organizations active and running at every single period throughout history. So yes, that makes a lot of sense.
And I guess I should also add that, of course, that association of some women activists with state feminism did backfire in the run when you think of the early days of the 2011 uprisings. There was a backlash against state feminism because of its association with Suzanne Mubarak and Hosni Mubarak, and it was actually one of the difficulties, one of the main challenges that women activists faced was to sort of take back women's rights as something that was the fruit of their struggle, despite the fact that the previous regime had claimed that as a sort of had monopolized that file, if you like. So although women can make gains, the danger of associating with state feminism is the danger of the backlash afterwards.
Right. I would like us to talk about also, you chose Egypt, Jordan, and Lebanon. So I was curious, in Egypt, we see a discrepancy in the public and private spheres as far as women's rights are concerned, particularly during the Nasser era. You mentioned that there's times in history when they had some gains in the public sphere, but in the private sphere, they didn't have as much gains, and they were still they still had a lot to achieve. Excuse me. In Jordan, you say that the number of women's organizations in the kingdom grew substantially, largely because of the Palestinian women's organizations, particularly after the 1948, due to the annexation of the West Bank, but also due to the creation of new organizations established to assist the Palestinian refugees. So do you think the political situation in Jordan with the influx of Palestinian refugees helped women be more active than they were in Egypt? Or did you see equal kind of participation and activism in both countries? I'm just curious about the difference or similarities between the two countries. Also taking into consideration that Jordan is a kingdom and Egypt turned into a republic after the 1952 revolution. So did the shift in the political establishment create any differences in the women's activism?
So I didn't really see any difference on the basis of a republican versus a monarchical regime. I think the difference really is the events that shaped, well, first of all, the sort of the historical events that occurred in each of those countries and how that might have impacted on regime consolidation. So in Egypt, the regime that came to power after 1952, the Nasser-led regime, was able to consolidate itself largely through its populist policies, but also through its anti-imperialist credentials. And that that popularity of the regime allowed it to get away with a lot more authoritarian measures than perhaps some other regimes, such as Jordan. And as a result, the regime cracked down on all forms of independent in Egypt, all forms of independent activism, including women's activism. So actually, it was very difficult for women to be activists in their own right under the Nasser regime. I couldn't really find any examples of women who were independent activists. There were state feminists, but not independent activists. Whereas in Jordan, the regime had to work a lot harder to gain popularity. And as a result, there was actually more freedom. And you also had the radicalizing effect of the 1948 war and the loss of Palestine and the influence that incoming Palestinian refugees also had on the political scene. So there were more independent women's organizations in Jordan compared to Egypt. However, that ended in 1956 when there was when the regime basically decided to also clamp down on all forms of independent activism. And that was with the help of the British and the US. So the monarchy put an end to that sort of liberal period in Jordanian politics. But for that period in which there was some freedom, there was the opportunity for women to create organizations, to create new initiatives. So there was a lot of activity. That's actually something that some people who don't know very much about Jordan might be surprised to know now, you know, given situation in Jordan now, that, you know, Jordan actually had a very thriving political scene for several years. So really, what I'm saying is actually it's quite important, the degree of political and civil freedoms within society. That sort of really makes a difference to the ability of independent women's activism to emerge. And then there's also the sort of emergency aspect. When there's a sort of national emergency, that also, so that's certainly the case in Lebanon during the civil war, that also gives an impetus for women to become involved in particularly forms of, say, humanitarian types of activism, because you know, it's all about the having to deal with the emergency, you know, that sort of suspends any normal expectations about what women should or shouldn't be doing.
That's very informative. There's a lot of details in the book that I would like to talk about, but one in particular that I think it would be interesting to address is you talk about the post-1980s and the end of the war and the fall of the Soviet Union and the rise of the U.S. as a superpower. At the same time, in the Arab world, there was a lot of repression of radical movements, which you say in the book has been with the complicity, if not the active help, of the United States and its regional allies, which pushed women out of contentious political activism and deprived them of spaces for performing alternative norms of femininity. So I was wondering if you could give us a little more explanation on your opinion regarding the role of the United States in pushing forward or hindering women's rights in the Middle East, and the active versus implicit role the U.S. plays in propagating certain ideas about the subjugation of women in the Arab world in general and the Islamic culture in particular.
So that's an important question. I would say that the US, like many other Western governments, often points to the oppression of women in other countries as a way of implicitly giving the image that the US is so progressive and women have all of their rights, and you know that the US is one of the only three or four countries, I'm not sure how many exactly, but so one of the very few countries that has not signed CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. So there's already like some big gap between the rhetoric and the reality when it comes to the US's position as somehow the ultimate standard in women's rights. The idea that part of the US's justification for its intervention in other regions of the world is that somehow it's bringing progress, civilization. I mean, these are a lot of continuity in the assumptions of underlying US foreign policy, as you know, similar to the discourse of in colonial times, you know, the European colonial discourse, that somehow, you know, the US is a force for good. You hear that a lot, actually, a lot of commentators saying that the US is a force for good in the world. And, you know, one of the awful things that Trump did was to tarnish the US's reputation as being a force for good in the world. So actually what the stories of the women activists in my book demonstrate is that the US was not a force for good in the Middle East. That when it came to the allies that the US supported, and its role in helping to bolster authoritarian and repressive regimes, and a key turning point, for example, is after Egypt signs the peace treaty with Israel and the US increases its aid to Egypt, its military aid and other forms of aid to Egypt. And this contributes to the ability of the regime to stay in power, you know, despite the fact that it was facing all sorts of problems. And that regime was and still is, you know, there's a lot of continuity there, a very repressive regime. So, and it's not just the Egyptian regime, it's also the Jordanian regime. And the way in which the US has intervened has also had very negative impacts on Lebanon as a small state which is very sensitive, highly sensitive to geopolitical fault lines in the region. So, and ultimately, these negative political implications of the US intervention impact on women. They impact on women's lives. They impact on the lives of their families. The worst case scenario is, you know, being caught up in war, to lose family members in war. And the best possible case scenario in this is, you know, to be to witness your standard of living being eroded because of neoliberal economic policies that the US has promoted alongside its allies in the region. So, yes, I would say that I think there's very little from the interviews that I did with women that would show that the US might have had a marginally positive role in some respects. That's really not at all what I learned from interviewing over 100 women.
That's a very interesting perspective. Thank you, Nicola. Actually, I do have still lots of questions for you, but I guess we've taken up a lot of your time, so thank you so much. But I would just like to end this podcast by asking, what are you working on now and what's your project after finishing this wonderful book?
Right. So at the moment, I'm working on something that's quite different, which is a book about popular culture and the Egyptian Revolution. Although gender comes into it, because that's part of what I look at, the way in which gender norms were reconfigured through popular culture in the middle of the sort of revolutionary period after the 2011 uprising. That's a book I'm writing with two other colleagues who worked with me also on the digital archive that we produced. And the other thing I'm beginning to I've been looking at for the past almost year is how COVID-19 is affecting women and gender relations in the Middle East. And I've been trying to get some grant money in order to create a project around that.
That's very interesting, Nicola. Like, I'm now all sparked up to read this book, and I really wish you all the best of luck and wish you more and more successes. Thanks a lot for your contribution. As an Egyptian myself, I really have to emphasize that I loved your book from a personal perspective as well as from a scholarly perspective. It offers a lot of views that we don't see a lot in scholarly articles, which, like we talked at the beginning, do fall in one binary or the other. But I loved how the book is authentic and speaks about women's voices and speaks the truth. So thank you so much. I can't thank you enough for that kind of contribution. And I really wish you all the best of luck with your new project. And I'm so looking forward to hopefully it coming out soon, and I hope I get the chance to talk about it with you sometime soon.
Thank you, Dina. Thank you. Your words really mean so much to me. So, yeah, I'm very touched. I'm glad that you you write the book so highly, and it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you again for the wonderful questions. I've really enjoyed this opportunity. So I hope we have other opportunities in the future as well.
The pleasure is mine, Nicola, and I do hope so too. All right. Thanks, everyone. I guess this gets us to the end of the podcast, and we look forward to more books. So thank you. You all have a good day.